In politics, you can't always get what you want, but you can ask, what's next? From SDPB, today is Wednesday, November 13th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, the leaks, the speculation, the announcements. We look into the future for South Dakota's biggest political players on the national scene. Our Dakota Political Junkies segment focuses on the influence of Governor Kristi Noem and U.S. Senator John Thune. Then, two history-making minority leaders in the South Dakota legislature join us. Senator Liz Larson and Representative Aaron Healy lay out their legislative priorities. But first, Rick Weiland is head of Dakotans for Health. He discusses an underfunded coalition and the future leaders for abortion access. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Constitutional Amendment G would have enshrined abortion rights into the state constitution. In 2006 and 2008, South Dakotans voted to protect abortion access. But in 2024, the measure lost, 58% to 41%. Rick Weiland is the head of Dakotans for Health. He led the campaign for Amendment G. He joined me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls yesterday. He's had a week to consider what happened during the campaign and look ahead to what comes next. You've had a little bit of time to think about what happened, and people have been asking you questions about what happened. So my question more specifically is, what's relevant about what happened?
Well, I think that, it's one thing to work hard and to mobilize the grassroots and raise a little bit of money to get enough signatures together to qualify a constitutional amendment, or in the case of even the food tax, an initiated law. But the other piece of that is you've got to have the money to get it into the end zone. And on both IM-28 and Amendment G, we simply did not have the resources to put together, an expansive ground game or to compete early enough on the airwaves. And when I say that, I mean, it's not just broadcast or commercial television. It's this streaming now digital platforms that have become very important. And other mediums. You got to have resources. And we fell short on both measures.
Yeah, both measures. So was there no coalition coming in? Talk a little bit about the coalition that you did form and what existed and what you had to create and what still exists afterwards. Help us understand
that.
Well,
we had a very impressive grassroots coalition through our Freedom Coalition and the work that Nancy Turbeck did. We had doctors group, lawyers group, a clergy group, a mothers and daughters group that really brought something at the grassroots level, but it didn't bring any money, which was really unfortunate. I mean, we for the most part, I think any time in a campaign, and as you know, I've been at this a while, when the opposition has the opportunity to get out a month ahead of time, and in this case, maybe a month and a half to 2 months with billboards and field signs and yard signs saying it's too extreme, and you can't answer that, it goes unchallenged for weeks. And then they reinforce it with a million and a half, $2 million on the airwaves. You get the outcome that we had. I mean, people, unfortunately, were convinced, a good share of them, that Amendment G was too extreme. And the fact of the matter is, I question whether or not there's a middle left in politics anywhere in the country, let alone in South Dakota. It was a very measured response. We got criticized from the Right to Life and the Catholic Church for being too extreme. And we got criticized from the left that we weren't extreme enough. Trying to find that middle ground to bring something that we thought people were familiar with, were comfortable with. We thought we would have the resources at the end of the day to be able to answer the right on their charges of too extreme, because all of their allegations, the charges they made were not factually based. They were fear-based. As we know in politics, sometimes fear trumps just about everything. If you can scare people enough, they're going to vote no or vote against, what's scaring them. And we saw that on Amendment G, and we saw that on the food tax. I mean, I wish I could say they had a argument or an allegation that was true. None of it was true. Zero.
So on Amendment G, one of the things, as I watched the late ads, I saw two things happening here in my community. One, billboards, which were very, I've said before, sort of bathed in pink and blue. You know, we love babies. Real men love babies. Grandparents love babies. Just you're sort of surrounded by this warm, feel-good kind of enticement and incentive to care about children. And then there were these very targeted ads saying, this is what Amendment G would do. It would mean that teachers could advise students to get an abortion, and we don't want that. And I was trying to unpack what exactly they were basing that on. And the only thing I could think of was that all the small pieces of legislation that have been passed over time that would restrict, you know, the waiting limits and the doctors have to read the script, those would have gone away under G. And so they were taking those and picking them out and saying, this is possibly what could happen, and that's why it's too extreme. So my question is there a way to go at the compromises that maybe need to be made to give people what they need, or is this not something that ends up on a ballot and it has to be done in the state legislature? And it's clearly not going to be done in the state legislature. Was it ever possible to put on the ballot a clean enough question that would maintain some of the guardrails that people seemed to want, or at least would have avoided, you know, some of the advertising attacks against it? Or is that just not possible? Because that gets to what needs to happen for your coalition.
But you have to unpack that.
Yeah.
You're talking about the Planned Parenthood Casey decision, which was several years after Roe was decided in 1973. We were talking about Roe in 1973. And those guardrails in, if you would call them that, and I think that in and of itself is inaccurate, because where does a 72-hour waiting period have to do, what's that have to do with anything? Or, you know, having to watch the sonogram or the video. I mean, all those things that came out of Casey became law because it allowed the states to further intimidate, if you will, women from having an abortion. It had nothing to do with things like rape, incest, fatal fetal abnormalities, which is what Roe protected. It's apples and oranges here. They wanted to talk about no parental consent. No, that was available under Roe. Any minor that has a medical procedure has to get consent from their parents. So that was never an issue, but they said it was, and they had enough money to drive that home, and we did not have enough money to push back.
Why didn't you have enough money to push back? Were people not behind it? Were you just not have enough people to ask?
No, I think that we were let down by a lot of the national organizations that weighed in other states and didn't weigh in South Dakota. I mean, you look at the successful Missouri ballot measure. I think they raised over $30 million, and most of it didn't come from Missouri. It came from around the country, and they won. I mean, they outspent the Right to Life organizations in Missouri, and they won. Florida got to 57%, but I think it was over $100 million, maybe $200 million campaign. You know, and I think, as I said at the beginning of this discussion, Lori, is that when you try to go for the middle ground, sometimes the alt-right and the alt-left, they aren't interested in the middle ground. And, you know, that's where we ended up, despite our efforts to try to engage groups like ACLU and Planned Parenthood and Center for Reproductive Rights and national donors that were interested in this issue. So that was part of it. The other part, you know, South Dakota wasn't a battleground state. okay? A lot of donors these days like to get, you know, what they call a trifecta. They want to be in states where it might make a difference in the national election at the presidential level, or if there's a competitive Senate race or a congressional race. So they want a threefer. They'll support abortion rights, but they know it's Pennsylvania and they know they got a competitive Senate race. You know, we had none of that going in to this campaign. My hope ultimately was, you know, using the construct of Roe, we were covering 99% of all abortions that occur in this country that happen in those first two trimesters, right? It's that less than 1% in the third, you know, which is pretty much universal around the country, right? Life, health exceptions in that last trimester. But when you can cover 99%, it was our hope that we would draw some national support, and it never materialized.
How far?
With the exception of one person.
How far do you think this sets women back in South Dakota?
I mean, to have to live in a state where if you're raped and you get pregnant, you have no options. If a pregnancy occurs as a result of incest and your daughter has no options. If a pregnancy turns into a non-viable, you know, fetal abnormality that, you know, can't be successful, can't get to term, or can't survive outside, you know, once the child's born, to force women to suffer through when they know what the outcome is going to be. I mean, I just think that that is barbaric. And I don't think women in South Dakota are going to stand for it. They'll be back. They'll be back, you know, with a vengeance. And I really fully expect that you will see something in the next 2 years. I have no expectation, despite their promises and all their money they spent to say that our current law isn't very good, but and we can maybe make it better. But G's too extreme. Well, now that's on them. We'll see what this legislature does with John Hansen in a leadership role. I really don't think there is an absolutism, if that's the right word, that life begins at conception and it's God's will, no matter what happens. You know, leave it up to God. And that's where a lot of this movement on the other side is. They don't want any exceptions. Zero.
So I have not talked to John Hansen yet, but the people I have talked to, when I say what's next, they largely say, we'll see what the other side's going to do. And previously, at the 2024 legislative session, when I was watching, perhaps incorrectly, for some kind of, you know, ongoing dialogue and compromise, saying, hey, before voters vote on this, you have an opportunity to put something into place that you feel is a legitimate compromise. And there was not that political appetite. So you're saying they're too extreme. They're saying you're too extreme. But then I'm also hearing you say that you were really kind of coming to the center a little bit in your legislation, which hampered your ability to raise money from the national organizations that thought maybe your measure was a little too conservative. At the end of the day, this is a battle between two very no room in the middle to compromise groups. And a whole lot of women are in the middle of that.
That's right. And it's unfortunate, although I do think Missouri might be an example of how a well-funded, reasonable measure, you know, to provide access for women could win even in South Dakota if it had the funding. You know, if the national orgs don't like, you know, the framework of Roe v. Wade, you know, we'll see what they what they're willing to support, and there are conversations going on right now. I'm not involved in them. I'm encouraging them. You know, I think that it's and I think I said this the other day. It's time for some new leadership on this issue, and I'm really hoping that, you know, despite the disappointing outcome, that we've built some real grassroots out there, and a lot of women leaders have emerged that weren't, you know, frankly, there when we started over 2.5 years ago. It was really hard to get women to engage. I think, because of intimidation, of just being afraid. It's not a comfortable space to be operating in when every day you're out there collecting signatures and you're being accused of being a baby killer and that your mother should have aborted you. And I mean, it's just, we went through a lot to get this on the ballot. I mean, 18 months of stalking our circulators, intimidating voters who wanted to sign, to bills they pass in the legislature on a straight party line vote, because that's what Right to Life wanted. And John Hansen's bill gets ushered through to allow people to withdraw their names from the Roe v. Wade ballot measure, which, by the way, they were so unsuccessful with. I don't think they got a single valid affidavit from the random sample, which is the only thing that really matters once you qualify, is that we had 723 people that came up in the affidavit, and not one of them submitted or came up in the random sample, but not one of them submitted a viable affidavit to have their name withdrawn. What happened was, is even the Secretary of State alerted the voters that there was this big scam going on and asked the Attorney General to investigate. And now then, pivot to a lawsuit, they were hoping to get in the mix before the election was over, and they failed to meet that deadline. So now we're still trying to figure out, even with the defeat of Amendment G, is this lawsuit still going to move forward? Or is it moot? The judge needs to weigh in. And so we'll see. But yeah, I mean, I think that we will hopefully have contributed to a effort with new leadership that is motivated, can learn some of the lessons that we learned. But I mean, for me, the bottom line is this has got to be changed. I mean, I have a 12-year-old granddaughter. And I think if something were to happen to her, I would do everything in my power to help her get through it based on whatever her family decided was right for her, what she wanted to do. And I think there are a lot of parents out there that are feeling the same way. It's just, when it comes to my own kids, my own grandchildren, this is barbaric. And you got to give people who become victims of the state an opportunity, or at least a choice, to be able to make decisions for themselves. And we don't have that in South Dakota. We now have the most restrictive abortion law in the entire country. Stop. End stop. Period. End of story.
There are people who would celebrate that.
Absolutely.
And would say that not only did they have a good ground game, but they had a good ground game because this is what the people of South Dakota want. They want to have a restrictive law for their own moral compass. Do you believe that?
No,
to be
I don't
true?
Believe that at all.
Why
they
not?
Had money. They had money. You can build a ground game when you have money. In our situation, the money that we were able to raise, we had to put it on the air. We had a little bit of a ground game, but not a $3.5-4 million campaign ground game. And I don't believe for a minute that this is what a majority of South Dakotans want. They just bought into the fact that they were being told G was too extreme. They didn't know why, but if it, by God, said that parents couldn't weigh in on a decision, or were aborting babies in the ninth month, or were killing them after they're born, I mean, and there's no ability to really push back,
right.
That's how you get to a 60-40 split. I can tell you this. I mean, in 2006 and 2008, which was a long time ago and things do change, but the efforts to restrict access were defeated by 10 points. And I also know that our own internal polling a month out had this thing at a dead heat. But as that money was pouring in on the other side, and us not being able to keep up with it, we saw that gap starting to widen. And I really do believe that had probably 90% of the reason we ended up where we did.
So the history lesson here.
You get it on the ballot, and you can do that with grassroots and a little bit of money, but you got to have enough money to get it into the end zone. And when you don't, you lose.
Politics and Public Policy Reporting is supported by the Center for Western Studies at Augustana University.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. South Dakota political leaders played big on the national scene this election cycle. President-elect Trump has selected Governor Kristi Noem as the nation's Homeland Security Secretary. Plus, U.S. Senator John Thune has been chosen as Majority Leader in the U.S. Senate. Brad Murdoch-Jurgensen is co-host of the weekly political podcast Dakota Town Hall, and he's our Dakota political junkie this week. I talked with him yesterday before those announcements were finalized. He stepped into our SDPB Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. All eyes are on the headline notification that pops up and tells you something. And did you see this? Did you see this? And this is very reminiscent of the first Trump administration where we saw internal leaks. The Supreme Court Dobbs decision leaked early. So as we look at some of the election, what happens next, we are already seeing information is really important and everybody's got something to say, but nobody's really talking.
No one's got anything to say.
What have you noticed about some of the response to, you know, who Donald Trump is going to choose, who the president-elect, I should say, is going to choose to come with him to the White House? Does it feel like deja vu?
Oh, for sure. So much of this feels like deja vu. But, you know, leaks has also become a hard word to define. It's been weaponized based on what side you're on is insulting. But let's just say what side you're on, right? So, like, there's the press you want and the hacks you don't, and then the editorial that both sides are trying to plant. And then and this is fair with every administration. When there's a transition, there's jockeying, and you need the reporter to leak this or that. But it certainly got gasoline on it with this new administration coming in, it seems.
All right. Everybody wants to know in South Dakota what happens to Governor Kristi Noem now that President-elect Trump is set to go back to the White House. And we have a little more information, even though it's not confirmed. Department of Homeland Security. That surprise you?
Yes. Yes, because only there, you know, the Dakota Scout had come out last week and said there was going to, you know, she was going to stay here. She had done an interview, you know, I like being governor, which is, of course, what you say. There was also speculation on interior agriculture, something, you know, maybe a little more experienced in a South Dakota governor's tenure. But there's also this, you know, the deportation and the Trump fan base needs some meat to be thrown to them. And I think Governor Noem is going to be good at that rhetoric.
So she built her reputation on loyalty to the president. And even in her most challenging public controversy, which is when her second book came out and the book tour was cut short and people were looking at the story of her shooting her dog, she was positioning it as, I'm not afraid to do the hard thing. And so in some ways that does lead to the Department of Homeland Security, perhaps in some uncomfortable ways and perhaps in some very predictable ways. What do you think that selection says about how President-elect Trump sees Kristi Noem and her reputation in the public spotlight?
I think it fits some of the other picks. I think if you look at, you know, the UN pick, these border czar picks, it's the more theatrical version of what the campaign was. And then you see Rubio as a Secretary of State pick. And so, you know, one would assume the kind of the Wall Street transition team that's been put in charge of this is seems like they're doing, you know, I don't mean to be dismissive to Homeland Security, but some of the more vitriolic end of Trump's campaign goes to picks like that, and then maybe some of the more establishment's a bad word right now, but establishment picks go into the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense.
We're also hearing the New York Times reporting, and as of note, we are recording this on Tuesday, and we're airing it on Wednesday, so this could
change. Could be wrong in
24
hours.
By the time that we that we go to air with this, but we're also hearing reported from the New York Times that people familiar with the inside conversation say some of future president's advisors do not want him to sit back and let South Dakota Senator John Thune take leadership role in the Senate. And so we also are waiting to hear who will lead the Republican Party in the U.S. Senate and whether or not it will be South Dakota Senator John Thune.
It seems hard to think it won't be Thune, given the amount of money that he put into Republican campaigns and to help, you know, candidly helping Trump have a very clear victory this campaign season. It seems the more, you know, entertaining end of the Trump world could get it done, because a lot of it is driven by, you know, the internet and social media. But it just seems like this is one of those times where he's got it locked up. But that could be wishful thinking, because we're all from South Dakota.
All right. So let's talk about other things that you noticed now that we've had a few days, a long weekend perhaps, to process some of the wins and losses of the election. What stands up to you with how South Dakotans voted last election day, a week ago now?
Oh, is it fair to say I'm disappointed in our turnout without sounding like sour grapes? I don't mean that towards one position. And, you know, certainly I worked on one of these issues. So I don't, people voted and they'd certainly made their mind very clear on the positions on this election day. But overall, it was still a lighter turnout than I think we have seen in other areas. That gives me a big red flag personally.
Wait, we had a low turnout? I thought we had a high turnout.
God, I think if you compare us to other states I looked at other districts, like, it was certainly a higher turnout than the June primary of 17%. But, like, it just seems like that last little bit of engagement we should be getting from our younger South Dakotans in their 30s, it's just not there.
Yeah. Let's go straight at the issue that you were supporting and just open that door a little bit. You were for recreational marijuana, and that failed.
It sure did. Boy, did it. Sorry.
So most of this hour is actually spent with people who did not have a super successful election day.
Oh, is it Loser Wednesday?
It is not Loser Wednesday.
I'm so happy to be on Loser Wednesday,
Let's call it What's Next Wednesday. However, what happened? What happened that you find relevant? Is this a money issue? Is this a, hey, South Dakotans just don't want recreational marijuana issue, misinformation? As you are doing your post-mortem, what are you finding?
It's certainly not one thing. It's a mixture of a lot of things. No, I don't think anybody from our camp has the idea that we thought, boy, that'd have done it, you know. Mm-hmm. I think the general consensus, and this, again, all of it sounds like finger point, none of it is there wasn't much of a yes on G campaign. And if you look at how we fared versus how they fared, if there would have been a more like how Kansas had theirs. Also, it seems like when you stack up a few of these issues against some conservatives, if abortion and recreational cannabis and a few other these things are on the same ballot initiative, conservatives tend to go generally no thank you to it all. So I certainly don't think it is the full measure of South Dakota's opinion on recreational cannabis, but I certainly think it is a indication of how conservative our voting base would like to stay.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about what happens next in the medical cannabis industry without recreational, because many people who were trying to hold some space until recreational passed are now saying this isn't worth it. What happens next for medical marijuana?
You'll see the industry shrink, certainly. You know, the state needs to remember in these instances, there's only 13,000 medical cards. That's not, you know, this is not a business necessarily that, you know, contrary to popular belief of the campaign, this is not a multi-billion dollar year industry for these people that are in it right now. So there'll certainly be some consolidation. I think there will be a huge increase in the appetite for medical cards at the same time where this legislature has some appetite for repealing medical.
All right. So what's next for you and people who want to continue to protect that or even expand it into the recreational space?
You know, ask a boxer how he feels after the fight. I don't think it's the right time to talk about the next fight. I think it's too soon to tell. I don't think there's any appetite for it in 2026. I think certainly more of the industry's appetite is focused on securing medical.
Meanwhile, we are seeing in other states challenges with competing against essentially the black market of marijuana. Even in states where it's legal, The regulations, the taxes, the, you know, the benefits, the things that people said, okay, we want, you know, to bring this in to make it a responsible, you know, business infrastructure, are losing to the nimbleness and the longevity of the underground marijuana market. How does that play out in South Dakota?
In the state of South Dakota, it's interesting. The black market plays out more. It's not, they're a legal business, but the Delta vape industry is far more influenceable into the marijuana space than the black market is here. The black market is more just in the general pipe of cannabis users, right? Okay. That's a much bigger end of the space. That's
what,
not
what
to
is?
Say you're
okay. Because yeah, I want to unspool this a little bit. Because what I'm hearing again and again is people shrugging their shoulders and going, "It's really easy to get anyway." So the people who want to get it already have their resources, illegal resources, but they're a little bit less upset about the loss because they're not really sure it's going to impact them. So that's why I'm asking the question. Like, well, if people are getting it illegally who want it, they weren't necessarily motivated or disappointed by the loss. And now you're talking about the vaping industry. So help me understand how to think about this from a bigger picture.
So let's back up and look at South Dakota. Just all of the places you can get cannabis or cannabis adjacent products legally, by the way.
Okay.
You can walk into any liquor store right now if they sell THC seltzers, and a lot of them do. And that is technically not cannabis. It is derivative of hemp. And under the U.S. Farm Bill, it is legal. You just have to be 21. You don't need a medical card. And you can walk into a liquor store and buy it today. In some gas stations and some smoke shops and, you know, these the ones that aren't dispensaries who put all the cartoony dispensary signs on their businesses, you can get some sort of Delta this or THC that, and none of that is tested, none of that is regulated. A lot of those have the candy kid packaging, like the Sour Patchy type stuff as well. And the only place that you can get, now I do sound like sour grapes, like absolutely 100% safe and tested cannabis, now it's sour grapes because it's too late, is a medical marijuana card in a medical marijuana dispensary. I have no idea what the black market's doing, to be honest with you, because I'm, you know, so deep into the legal end of this. I don't think the black market cares what I think, but
yeah. And I don't know either. I just know people are saying that to me. People are saying, you can get it anywhere. I'm like, but, I don't know what that means.
Yeah, people are saying a lot of things right now.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. For the first time, South Dakota Democrats have selected two women to lead their party in the state legislature. Senator Liz Larson and Representative Erin Healy are minority leaders in their respective chambers. Both women represent District 10, and they both joined me in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls to talk about their goals next session.
So it's the very first time that a Democrat, a woman who is a Democrat, has been elected both as a Senate leader and a House leader. And then it's also the first time in history that there is a woman leader in both the House and the Senate. I did not know going into our elections that that was the case. I could have sworn there was a female leader of the Democratic caucus prior to the 100th legislative session, but that wasn't the case. And so that was really exciting to hear that this has happened.
Yeah. I also had no idea until someone else wrote an article about it. And then I'm like, wow, that's fascinating. I had no idea.
Yeah. So the significance of this and how you will think about this going forward, perhaps people are paying a little bit more attention then to your leadership. What are your thoughts going in, Senator Larson? That is that a mantle that you're going to carry? Is that something you're going to talk about to school children? Like, how do you to leverage that in a way that has the most impact?
I haven't developed a specific strategy just for that, but I think I'll focus like I've been focused on the past, which is I like to focus on bipartisan issues. And, you know, given our increasingly divided political dialogue that we have here in our country, I've always tried to focus on the common narratives that we have as South Dakotans. Because I feel like those are what are actually under attack with the toxicity of our political dialogue. So it, in a weird way, that the whole, you know, that we're the first women elected to lead the Democrats is also kind of overlaps on that because, I mean, it is all a way that we have a common experience as South Dakotans, and we can lean into that and bring those experiences out through our conversations, through our dialogues, and through the policies that we make.
Yeah. I feel like during the election, things get just about as nasty as they can possibly get. And not that that doesn't happen during the legislative session, Representative Healy, but then once the session starts, every Democrat will tell you the same thing. We'll get nothing done if we don't work together. This is the time to focus on commonalities. Is that what you find? You know, building coalitions and making decisions about how you're going to vote as a caucus, there's a lot more trying to find the commonality than fighting to withhold a stronghold on something that you might not win anyway because of the supermajority.
Exactly. I think it's really important that as our caucus develops our priorities, we look at issues across the state that most South Dakotans care about. Childcare, access to health care, our economy. These are all issues that affect how we as South Dakotans live. And it's important that we continue to talk about it. It's the right thing to do. It's the way that we can build our communities. And ultimately, they're the issues that we can focus on because we know that this is something that so many people care about, regardless of political affiliation.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about some of those priorities. It is early, and you've kind of outlined a few things. But going into the session, what are some of your early thoughts on things you're either watching for from the Republican caucus or that you might be bringing as Democrats to say, this is something that we feel people can get behind? Where do you want to begin?
Well, I think that first and foremost, we really want to protect public education. And we know that that is a very big priority, especially for our district. You know, we have an urban district. I'm a graduate of Lincoln High School. I've gone to public education my entire life. We really want to protect and invest in our public schools. We also are going to focus on lowering costs for families. We know that, like Aaron was saying, the economic picture today and surviving as a family is getting more difficult, and that ranges from everything from healthcare to childcare and, you know, everything in between, cost of food, cost of living. Those are all also really important to voters, and we'll be concentrating on safeguarding those. We also want to focus on the freedoms that we experience, whether that is protecting women's health, protecting IVF, protecting voter rights. And so we're kind of looking at a basket of items that are under that realm as well.
Representative Healy, what would you add to that?
Yeah, I guess I would add Medicaid expansion and protecting Medicaid expansion because we know that we just passed the constitutional amendment for the legislature to investigate work requirements. And we know we have been very vocal about being opposed to this idea because we know that this doesn't work in other states and that it won't work here in South Dakota. And all South Dakotans deserve access to health care regardless of their work status.
Do you think that will come up in the first legislative session? Tony Van Huysen, who was a proponent of that legislation, said he had no plans of bringing a bill yet because of the complexities of the administrative pathways that would have to go through. But in the future, certainly it would be. So how do you lay that groundwork when you know, Aaron, that voters voted for this? And, you know, it's a complicated situation. What kind of conversations do you need to have in session one when there's no bill on the table to help people understand what those work requirements should or could be now that lawmakers have sort of the permission to consider them?
I think we need to continue storytelling why healthcare, access to healthcare is so important, why people need to have insurance, why people who are not working need healthcare and coverage. And the more that we talk about this, regardless of whether there's a bill, the more we can paint a picture as to what's actually happening here in our state. And we can potentially work through some of those misconceptions that I know some of my colleagues in the legislature believe. And that's what we can do for now is continue to chip away at these commonly held beliefs that aren't true.
And just one more thing to add to that. I think in addition to telling the stories, we need to tell the story about the fact that having families be one healthcare crisis away from bankruptcy is bad economic policy. The bedrock for our own economic growth as a state is to fight these things. In a state that has 2% unemployment, to add a bunch of you know, bureaucratic processes to something that is just a basic fundamental part of our economy that needs to be there is just, it's not good policy.
Yeah. You mentioned lowering costs for families, which I think is an important way to phrase it, and everything that comes under that umbrella of mm-hmm. what it costs to raise a family right mm-hmm. now. Are there ways that lawmakers can lower costs for families? What would some of those ways be?
Well, it could be by removing the tax on food. That's one way. There are other things that come up. I think there's been a long discussion on childcare, which Aaron probably knows more about than I do, but that is such a big cost for families right now. We see a lot of cases of people quitting jobs so that they can take care of their kids because they make less money than it would cost for them to put their kids into daycare. So it's just a really big economic issue. Those are the first things that come to mind.
One other thing that comes to mind is property taxes. I know that that's been a huge discussion in our legislature the past few years, and we have to find a way to make housing more affordable here in South Dakota.
Yeah. So property taxes, the food tax, which voters declined to pass, and the state tax reduction that has a sunset clause. So taxes could be a big theme again for this 2025 legislative session, in theory.
Yeah.
In theory.
Yeah. Also public education.
Yes.
We're sort of predicting a little bit that there are going to be a lot of conversations about what that means and what it doesn't mean.
Yep.
Coming up. A 100th anniversary of the legislative session. Let's talk about some of the things that are interesting about our session and begin with the people who show up, who drive to Pierre, and can stop you in the hallway and talk to you or step up to the microphone during a committee hearing. What have you noticed about that process in South Dakota and people coming and telling, we'll start with you, Representative Healy, their stories about what it's like to live here and what they want lawmakers to hear?
I'll start by saying this. Pierre isn't the easiest place to get to, right?
Geographically,
it's not the easiest place to get to. We make it there every week, and we have to. And there's a lot of lobbyists there who are there on behalf of people, too. We do hear from a lot of constituents, and luckily there are constituents who are able to make their way to Pierre. But I do wish that it was more accessible to other people. We recently, because of COVID, we have been able to hear more testimony via the internet and people that can call in and give their testimony. But I truly hope that we continue to make it
encourage
accessible.
Encourage involvement.
Yeah, like I truly hope that we continue to make testimony more accessible. Mm-hmm. That we really encourage involvement. Quite often, we hear from lobbyists and other lawmakers on behalf of certain bills.
Sure.
But it would be so much more beneficial for legislators to hear from their constituents.
Yeah. How do you make it okay, Senator Larson, for people to come and talk to their lawmakers? How do you listen to people, especially if someone comes from your district that, you know, didn't vote for you? You represent those people as well.
Absolutely, yeah. And I always put this on my automatic response message. Anybody who says in their email to me that they are a constituent of District 10, I will try my darndest to write back to them. There might be one or two that scoot by that, you know, and when everything's so busy that I miss, but I will write back to everybody that says they're from my district because we get lots of emails and not all of them are worth our time. So we're kind of going quickly through our emails and trying to filter out which ones are the most important. And so that is our top priority. So for people who want to contact their lawmaker, make sure that you say that you are from their district really upfront, and then they will pay attention.
Yeah.
And I think I can also expand on that. So Senator Larson mentioned like not worth our time. And it's not that an email is not worth our time, but sometimes we get form emails.
Mm-hmm.
So you fill out your name and you fill out your address, and it will automatically send a letter, an email to that representative or that senator. We really appreciate hearing straight from our constituents and the words that that best express an issue in their own way, in their own story. That's also really important is trying to take a few extra minutes to convey your message in a way that is important to you and that shares the importance as to like why we should or shouldn't be supporting a bill.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. we are hearing, and nothing is confirmed at the time that you and I are recording this conversation, about Governor Kristi Noem's political future in the Trump administration. As that becomes more clear, there is a real possibility that Lieutenant Governor Larry Roden will lead the legislative session. Not sure how that will happen or unfold yet. Senator Larson, you've worked with him pretty closely in the past. What are some of your thoughts about the governor and her political future, and then the possibility of a very different legislative session with a different governor?
Yeah. Well, as you know, Lieutenant Governor Roden is the president of the Senate, and so he's presided over the Senate every day that I've been there for 2 years. I find him to be really down to earth, an approachable person. He's a conservative Republican. He's a rancher. He doesn't take any guff, and he knows legislative procedure. So as a senator, I would be sad to see him go if he becomes governor, although I'd certainly be the first to congratulate him on that.
Representative Healy, what would you add?
Yeah, Lieutenant Governor Roden has been serving the people of South Dakota for quite some time. From my perspective, he's been a strong supporter of South Dakotans. Obviously, we're on different sides of the aisle, but I welcome him to working more closely with the House. And I look forward to potentially addressing some issues here in South Dakota that are really important to the people. And I think that he'll recognize that as well.
Tell me about your colleagues. You lost some people, including Cameron Nelson from District 10, was replaced by a Republican. The Democratic caucus has decreased. The number of Democrats sent to Pierre has decreased since 2008. So it continues to shrink a little bit. But yet there have been some significant additions from the Rapid City area. There's a lot happening, and it makes your role unique in a supermajority. However, if you want to invite more Democrats into the political process or convince more independents to cast votes for Democrats in the future, what's the ground game going forward?
I can start with that. I've been in the legislature since 2019, and I've witnessed the shrinking of our caucus. And the one thing that hasn't changed is we are resilient people. We're resilient as a party. We're resilient as a caucus. We, regardless of how many people are in our caucus, will always strive to do what's right and to hold true to our values while also working across the aisle. I think, like as we've mentioned before, that's really important. But nothing's changed here. We will still fight for what's right. We will still focus on our priorities and what needs to be done, and we'll continue to talk about that. And my hope is that our state recognizes that people who want to see positive, progressive change for our state start to see the work of our caucus, regardless of how small we are, and respects that.
We're small but mighty, we hope.
Well, we will be checking in with you, of course, throughout the legislative session, and we thank you for giving us a preview today.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time.
Senator Liz Larson and Representative Aaron Healy. Both are Democrats and both represent District 10 in the city of Sioux Falls. They've been selected as minority leaders for the 2025 legislative session. The majority leaders are Republican Senator Jim Melhoff and Representative Scott Odenbach. We sent them invitations to join today's program. They've declined for now, but they have said they'd be happy to join us in a future conversation. We're looking forward to hearing their priorities as the legislative session gets closer. That is our show for today. We hope that it served you from all of us at SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.